So friends, as we mentioned before, as you all know, the purpose of, you know, the meditation within the Buddha's teachings is to be able to understand our mind and especially understand how, you know, it's our mind that either creates its problems and sufferings for itself, or it can create our, be the source of our happiness and wisdom. But it's all about being able to use our mind in the proper way and to understand what this mind is. This mind is the most powerful thing, you might say, in the whole universe. Because actually it's the mind that is our creator. Our mind creates basically our experience of the world. And the Buddha has summed this up very precisely in the first two verses of the Dhammapada, which go that all actions are led by the mind. Mind is their master, mind is their maker. If one acts or speaks with an impure state of mind, then suffering will follow. As the cartwheel follows the foot of the ox. In the same way, if one acts or speaks with a pure state of mind, then happiness will follow, as your shadow follows you without departing. And in another very profound statement, he said that the world, the arising of the world, the ceasing of the world, and the path leading to the ceasing of the world is right here within this 5 or 6 foot long body with its nervous system, memory and consciousness. So, you know, in the practice of meditation, we're trying to really find our mind, because most people are sort of just lost within their thoughts and they're not really aware of their thoughts in a deep way. They're just lost in their thoughts, and the thoughts, many people are enslaved by their thoughts, but they're not the master of their thoughts. And the mind creates so many delusions and so on. So how do we get control over the mind? How do we learn to tame the mind? And I've mentioned this morning that, you know, we reach the mind through the body. But for most people, their mind is not in the body. Although the mind is in the body, but in a way, it's not grounded in the body. And most people's minds are lost in the past and future. They're not, really grounded in the present moment. And the mind is a jump ahead of itself. The body and mind have become sort of split. They don't work in coordination. They don't work in harmony. Because the body is doing one thing, but the mind is doing so many other things. And basically the mind is not really in touch with the body. About the only time we feel the body is when you get a toothache or a migraine headache, or you stub your toe, or you get some pain, then temporarily the mind is pulled back into the body. Or if you develop some serious disease or other things, then the mind gets quite preoccupied with the body. But normally the mind is caught up in daydreaming, or in the past and future, or simply focused externally, not aware of what one is doing. So this creates a lot of problems. And, you know, the typical examples that you're walking down the street not paying attention to what you're doing, not aware of the body, the mind is lost in a daydream, or it's looking at, you know, something across the street, or it's brooding over its problems, or churning up anger about somebody, sort of lost in that, and, you know, you bump into a tree, or you step in something dirty on the ground, or you bump into somebody, or you almost get hit by a car because you wander out in the street. A horn honk, "Hey buddy!" Then it comes back to reality. So lots of accidents occur because our mind is not centered and grounded in itself. And the mind is always rushing into the future. It's a step ahead of the body. And it's not paying attention to the signals of the body. So we do a lot of things also that are harmful for our body. Like, let's say, eating certain types of, you know, junk food, or doing other types of behavior that cause the body overstress or put it into danger, because really we're not listening to it. And so the mind and body are basically sort of split or separated. And there's a term for that in the in yoga, they call it psychic disassociation, but you could term it also mara. It's when the body and mind become split and are working at odds to each other. So, you know, the body is always trying to tell us something like, you know, "Oh, don't put that into me." You know, you start to eat some junk food or something, or some other substance, alcohol or tobacco. You know, the body's trying to say, "Don't put that in me, don't put that in me." But we're not listening, because the greed in the mind says, "Shut up, I'll do what I want." And so we're just chasing after our greed and not paying attention to the body. Then the body winds up suffering, and then our mind winds up suffering also. So anyway, so the first stage of really meditation is to learn how to bring the mind back into the body so that they work in coordination and they help support each other. And so when the you know, the body is sitting, you know, the mind should be sitting also. When the body is standing, the mind should be standing. That means it's relaxed and kind of resting in the body with awareness. And that way it'll be directly in touch with the signals that are moving through in the body. And this body and nervous system is sort of the central clearinghouse for everything else. The whole world passes through our senses. The ears, eyes, nose, tongue, the skin, and the mind. The whole world is passing through the nervous system. And we're creating our experience of the world through the constant information that's moving through our nervous system to the brain, where we have cognition and consciousness. So, and also when you grounding the mind in the present moment, again, the mind rests in the present moment. The mind's natural vibration or the mind's natural state is just being in the present moment, awareness. And the body is the real home for the mind. Look, when you were born, you know, from the mother and father, they, you know, produced a one cell little organism, and then the mind coming from a past life has planted itself into that little zygote, whatever they call it. So the whole mind coming from the past is now in a, you know, one cell. And it's very powerful. And then those cells have multiplied as, you know, the baby grows older until it's, you know, fully grown. But with each multiplication of the cell, you know, that mind is also infused into the cells. So basically the mind, every cell of our body has consciousness. And that's how embedded the mind is in the body. But again, we've sort of lost touch with that through our focus in the external world. So how to regain our center and how to bring the mind back into the body so that we can be aware of the energies that are constantly moving through us. And also we can be more relaxed. And the body is the natural home for the mind. And there's nothing necessary to focus and worry about. It should just naturally kind of just come back within and rest in the present moment. It's like a bird sitting in its nest. So this body is the nest for our mind. Our mind is always flying out to get food. It's like the bird flies out to get food. It comes back to the nest. So in the same way, our mind is running through the past and future, is reacting to the various sort of objects outside, and gets all, you know, involved in the web of karma and stress and anxiety and worry. But it doesn't know how to relax. It doesn't know how to come back and rest in the present moment. And that's the skill of meditation. And you know, the starting point for the meditation. So the first stage of meditation, as we mentioned, is, you know, bringing the mind out from the external world and allowing it to rest in the present moment. And, you know, in meditation practice, we take up the attitude of the Buddha, of, you know, this is a scientific experiment. You know, we're trying to find the mind. And so we have to conduct an experiment. And the mind is within this body, the source of our thoughts. So we have to, we use the body as like the laboratory to conduct this experiment of what our mind is. And, you know, the Buddha, he left the palace and searched for enlightenment, but he went and studied with so many teachers, other teachers, following their methods, listening to what they had to say. Just sort of following others. And he, you know, did that, but then he realized that wasn't really the, you know, the ultimate truth. So he said, you know, enough with this wandering around, listening to other teachers. Let me, sit down under the Bodhi tree and find the truth within myself. So that's his attitude. And he sat down under the Bodhi tree and looked within himself to discover the truth of existence, the truth of the mind. So that's the attitude when we meditate, of conducting a scientific experiment. But so this body is like the laboratory, and our mind is like the microscope. But just as a laboratory, when you go into the lab, the laboratory table has to be firmly fixed to the ground. If you have a laboratory table on wheels, was moving around, and when you try to look through the microscope and it's jiggling around, you won't be able to see very clearly. So the same way, the body has to be kept still, like the laboratory table. And then the mind is like the microscope. And then when you sort of look down through the microscope, and looking and feeling at the body, and developing the mindfulness and concentration. In the mind, the awareness that's resting in the present moment, that's also the liberated mind. It's the mind being lost in the past and future, that's the source of all problems. All problems are problems of the past and future. Try to think of any problem that you have that's not related somehow to the past or future. Even if it's the future, the next second or the next minute. But all anxiety, worry, fear, guilt, worry, remorse, greed and hatred is all connected to objects of the past and future. But we don't know how to rest in the present moment because we've lost that natural ability through the course of evolution and through our craving for the external world. We've lost touch with our natural home. So that's really what we want to try to cultivate and to recontact our natural dwelling place, which is the present moment of the body. Of course, you have to think, and you have to think of the past and the future sometimes, especially the future, but not to be obsessed and lost into the future, to know how to always come back and rest in the present moment. And the body and mind is like a five-layered cake, or there's five layers to the body-mind experience, and each one is subtler than the next one. So the physical body, we first have to bring the mind to rest, find the physical body. So we find it sitting, or standing, or walking. So we bring our attention from the external world and actually, to the surface of the body. That's the first stage. And as you keep your attention on the surface of the body, just simply being aware of it, sitting, feeling like the buttocks, the feet, the hands, even just the surface contact points of the body. But if you hold your attention there long enough, or the breathing, the air first strikes the nostrils, and then the expanding and contracting of the breathing process, So as you hold your attention there longer and longer, then you get under the skin. The next level stage of meditation is kind of feeling the subtler sensations that are going on underneath. Because we want to reach the mind, but the mind is operating at the cellular level of the nervous system. That means the source of our thoughts. They are arising in this sort of from the unconscious mind, our thoughts and impulses or urges, like the urge to want to move or scratch. You know, those are arising from like the unconscious mind. But if we're not centered in the present moment, then we won't see them. And so we'll just react automatically or neurotically to the various stimulations that are coming through us, because only in their, you know, we see them only after they've triggered off our nervous system, because our mind is dull. Our awareness is very much slowed down because of our clinging and attachment. The mind has become very slow to awareness, slow to be alert to things. How many people got lost in your thoughts this morning? Just raise your hand if you got lost in your thoughts. So why do you get lost in the thoughts? It's because you didn't see them coming. Your mind was either you were partly sleeping or you were daydreaming, and you didn't see the thought that originates sort of deep inside. And only when that thought is broken on the surface of our mind and has triggered off already all the various enzymes and adrenaline and other sorts of things, only then do we recognize it, after it's already engaged our nervous system. But by then it's more difficult to let it go, to deal with it. And so we have to expend a lot of energy trying to get our mind out of that thought or that other hindrance. And that is always sort of then diluting our meditation. So, you know, having the mind grounded and centered deep in the body, then you can see the first impulses of thought and feeling arising, and your awareness will be right there, seeing it when it's still a very weak, when it's still just a little blip on the radar screen. You can see, anger's arising. You have time to relax around it and not allow it to build up and consume your mind. Or you're aware of the first onset of pain, and you can alert yourself, pain's rising, okay, relax, it's nothing much. And you can kind of relax around it and just observe it as it's starting to well up, you know, before it's engaged the nervous system. So that's really the kind of the skill in the meditation, in learning to overcome the hindrances. So, you know, the three main hindrances to meditation are physical pain, sleepiness, and the monkey mind. These are the things that block our mind from becoming centered in the present moment and for developing alertness and concentration. So I want to talk briefly about dealing with those hindrances. And especially the pain. Now, people that are not used to sitting in the meditation position or anything you do for the first time, naturally there's going to be discomfort, because the muscles and joints have to get used to the stress, especially of like sitting in a meditation position. People are not used to the knees and the hips and the ankles being, you know, kept in a position for a long time. So pain will arise. And that's natural. But observing pain is an important part of meditation. And the whole of the Buddha's teachings is centered around dukkha. And the physical pain is an important part of that. Although the mental suffering is more important. So there's physical pain, but the mind that struggles against the pain, that is what leads to the suffering. The physical pain is physical, but it's the mind's resistance to the physical pain that's the dukkha. So suffering is mental, whereas pain is more physical. So learning how to, first of all, again with the posture, that's why learning how to sit in the right posture is important, because if you don't, then you're going to be fighting against the pain much longer. And also sleepiness. And the best posture for meditation is the one where both knees and the buttocks are firmly grounded to the floor. We call that the tripod position. And the knees should touch the ground. If the knees are higher than your buttocks, you're sitting like this, it will be very unstable, because you're kind of not really grounded. And you won't be able to keep the lower back straight. Actually, that's the most important part of the posture, is learning how to keep the inward curve of the lower spine in place. The spine has a natural inward curve, the lumbar vertebrae. It's there for a purpose, because it supports all the weight of the upper body. Half the weight of your body and bones and muscle and everything else is, you know, from the waist upwards. And that's a lot of weight pushing down, as I mentioned before. So learning how to keep the inward curve of the lower spine there helps to support the upper body. But if you let that go out, then you have that weight always pushing down, and it's going to create pains and the resistance of trying to keep the body up is going to create more pains. And the unnecessary weight of this slouching, it crams everything down onto the joints of the spine, as well as the hips and the knees, and you know, causes more pain. That's why learning to sit upright, whether that weight is not pushing down, it frees up the joints and so on of the lower body, or the whole body, and minimizes the pain. So that's the, you know, just one way of learning how to sit, you know, sit in the right position. But even if you're sitting in the right position, there's still going to be pain. And especially like itches, prickling sensations and itches and stinging sensations, all kind of things occurring within the body. you know, so many different processes that are happening. You have billions of cells and molecules that are rubbing into each other and active and going through the process of supporting life. And the interaction of the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, and all the chemical and electrical impulses that are going through the nervous system. These are all producing infinite varieties of sensations that will be felt as sort of aches and pains and itches and prickling sensations, stinging sensations, so many of them. And when you meditate, when your mind is no longer distracted outside and you bring it inside, then you start to feel so many of those things. And that's what we react to. And that we don't we get irritated by those various types of sensations. But that's a very important part of the practice in strengthening your mind. So that you actually take that up as a specific meditation. When the mind is able to center and focus in the middle of the body, then on purposely being alert for the various itches, scratching sensations, stinging sensations, aches and pains that you'll be able to notice. And you train your mind to relax around it and to accept it. Normally we're always trying to get rid of them, itching this, rubbing that, moving this, always, you know, trying to find a comfortable, painless position. And there's never going to be one. And so that's what distracts so many people's meditation, is they get disturbed by these various types of uncomfortable sensations going on. So after one as one develops concentration and mindfulness through the breathing body, then while the breath is going on, those various sensations arising, those become your secondary objects. You know, you become mindful of them, mindful of itching, itching. And you're aware of, an itch. But you don't move your hand to scratch it. You just observe. And you see how it wells up, it comes to a peak. It lasts a few seconds longer, then it disappears. And then something else will arise. There's always something occurring in the body, actually. There's always many things arising within the body. And that becomes a main focus of the attention. Especially when you're opening up to the flow of impermanence. But even while you're trying to develop concentration, it's being you get distracted by various itches and pains and you lose your concentration. So learning how to relax in and around and through the various aches and pains coming up is an important just as much an important part of the practice as just concentrating. Because that's transforming the nervous system. You know, the practice of meditation is transforming the nervous system from a neurotic one to a more mellow one. And learning how to change the sankharas. You know, sankharas are habit patterns. So every time you move or itch or rub or scratch something or move from pain, you increase that habit. You increase the hatred and aversion in your mind to the, you know, to dukkha vedana. So, an important part of the training is understanding that all these various little aches and pains, itches, irritable sensations, 95% of them are not life-threatening and are going to hurt you in any way. Even probably 99% of them. But we allow them to keep annoying our mind and getting distracted. So, you know, that can be taken up as a specific, you know, meditation in itself, just watching the various itches, aches, pains, stinging, biting sensations, itching sensations that are coming up, and learning how to relax the nervous system and open up to see how all those things are just impermanent. And build up your pain tolerance. You have to build up your threshold, the pain threshold in the mind. Normally we have little tolerance for pain, so I just rush to get rid of it by taking an aspirin or changing our posture and trying to getting away from any type of discomfort. But that will chase us our whole life. So in meditation, you're kind of taking a stand against that. And in cultivating insight, you realize that actually 99% of those annoyances and discomforts are basically not real. Or they, you know, they're not life-threatening or not going to harm us in any way. So to sort of take a stand against them and to learn how to sit and relax through that. And to build up the amount of time you can endure pain before you finally shift and change your posture. Now there's some pains, of course, that may be, you know, serious, let's say. You have some certain types of pains that could be some signal that something's going wrong, or something that could be, let's say, more damaging. But, you know, those are fairly few. It's our mind that makes a mountain out of a molehill, or it takes some sensation and then thinks it's worse than it is, and then it struggles, and then it becomes a distraction for the meditation. So whenever you notice some pains arising, or, you know, you have to be, that mindfulness is alert to it, and you have to be aware, this, you know, pain is arising. You can make a mental note of pain, or simply distraction. Basically, it's dukkha vedana. It's like the Vedanusati. You know, painful feeling is arising. But you alert yourself and relax the body and mind, and follow its a build up, but without identifying it as being, you know, me or mine. It's just the body. You know, a body sensation, and it will well up, change, and vanish. And then you come back to your, you stay grounded, keep grounded to the breathing body. I'll talk more about that later on. Then with the sleepiness, if you're getting sleepy, in meditation, sleepiness has many causes. It's usually just our overworked mind. And excessive thinking and worrying and so on probably makes you more tired than going out and rolling boulders. you know, picking up loves, physical exertion. The mind that's obsessed with just the various thoughts, worries, fears. It drains our energy and can produce sleepiness. But in the meditation, the first thing you should notice is, you know, you've lost awareness of the body and the chin goes down. And then you're starting to slouch. That means the mind is going into sleepiness. It means it's not awake. So by being fully awake to the posture, then the mind, it's impossible to go to sleep. But as soon as we lose that, then the mind starts sinking. So the best way to overcome sleepiness is to try to keep, you know, keep straightening up the body and keeping the body alert. So that the nervous system energy can be circulating freely through all the senses and keep us in the most alert state. But you can do deep, slow breathing. So if you catch yourself, you know, drowsing, then it's a good idea to take some deep, slow breaths, breathe in, to fill up the lungs or to bring the air into the upper part of the chest and hold the air in for several seconds or longer so that you get all the oxygen in the lungs has a chance to transfer to the bloodstream and be taken out to all the cells and tissues to sort of charge them up. So by taking a few deep, slow breaths, sort of pump up the nervous system with oxygen, can help you then become more awake. But if you keep on, you know, nodding out, and then at some point it's better to stand up and continue your meditation in the standing position rather than spending the whole meditation kind of just battling the sleepiness. When you do standing meditation, then you're not apt to go to sleep because of the fear of falling down. So it helps you to stay more awake. Standing meditation is a better posture for those who have a lot of sleepiness. Or the walking meditation. Now, coming to probably the biggest hindrance, and that is your thoughts. Being lost in the thoughts. The Buddha has given some advice on how to deal with distracting thoughts in your meditation. It comes from a sutta, the Vitaka Santana Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya. The removal of distracting thoughts. So usually the first, whenever you have when a thought comes up while you're meditating, the first thing you should try to do is, you know, recognize that it's just thinking. You know, thought is arising now. And you sort of try to just watch it. Maybe a thought of, I wish I had ice cream. Or a thought of, magiputa, magidua. Whatever it is, you know, millions of thoughts. So you recognize it as just thinking. You're aware that thought is trying to steal your mind away now. And if you catch it soon enough, that may be enough for the thought just to disappear. If you have good mindfulness. But the thought may come back again, especially if it's something important to you. So there's so many types of thoughts that will come to our mind. Many of them are just disassociated, just random sort of thoughts that don't have a whole lot of meaning. But there's some that are very important to us, especially ill will, thoughts of, you know, a resentment about somebody who recently hurt you, Or maybe some obsession with the future. You're worrying about your future. You're going to lose your job. Or you just found out you got a positive test from the doctor back, you know, or something. Or one of your relatives is dying. So many thoughts that keep coming back over and over. So the Buddha gave advice on how to deal with those recurring thoughts. And generally, just give it, we call it, you know, throwing a dog a bone. So it's like a dog that keeps running after you, trying to bite your trousers or pant leg, you know, and you kind of shake it off. And 10 seconds later, it comes back again. You kind of shake it off, and it keeps coming back again. So, mokra karan. What? You pick up a stick and you throw it. Right? So the dog runs after the stick. You have enough time to go into your yard and shut the gate. Or the dog gets distracted by the stick and you're able to get away. So in a similar way, we have to throw our mind a bone. That means we think of something else. We think of it of the opposite kind of thought. So we substitute some kind of negative thought with some kind of positive thought, or the opposite kind of thought. Or we can actually, the first thing you should ask yourself is, why is this thought coming to me? You know, you analyze the thought. You leave aside your meditation, your, let's say, watching your breath for momentarily, and, you know, why is this thought coming to me? What is so important about this? And you can kind of analyze it. You know, if it's an angry type of thought, somebody hurt you. So you try to analyze it to get some clarity on it. And understand that, you know, if you kind of analyze it, and somebody hurt you, okay. But then you're identifying with that person. So you can understand that this person did something to hurt me, but because they themselves are sick. They didn't do it because they wanted to. They themselves are suffering from greed, hatred, and delusion. And, you know, they did this. And then you're clinging to yourself also. So what if they said something or did something? But it's your reaction, you're clinging to even your self-image, you're clinging to whatever they insulted you with or tried to steal from you. You're clinging to that. So you analyze it in that way and try to let go, and then you can substitute, you can practice metta. Instead of continuing to generate anger toward the person, you try to have compassion for that person as being sick, and then wish them to be free from their sickness. And send them metta. May they be free from greed, hatred, and ignorance. May they be well and happy. So that you don't go on just generating those angry type of thoughts. And while you're doing that, then the thoughts may disappear. So you substitute an opposite kind of thought. But if it keeps coming back, then you examine the dangers in that thought. And if I keep harboring these thoughts, then I'm going to take some action. That thought may turn into some actual action, some karmic action to get revenge on a person. or that thought is just poisoning you. It's like poisoning for yourself. It's not hurting the other person. You're sitting here trying to make your mind peaceful through meditation, but yet you're making your mind agitated by cultivating these negative thoughts. So you're seeing that you have to analyze the futility of that thinking and the danger in harboring that thought that's really just poison for yourself. So while you're analyzing it that way, the thought may disappear also. Or you trace the thought back to its source. What triggered off this thought? And whatever triggered off the thought, you ask, well, what triggered that off? And then you keep on trying to take the cause back further and further to see how it had really no empty, just some empty basis for arising, and then let go of it. Whether it's anger or whether it's something lust or desire, and you can contemplate the the nature of attachment, and that we only focus on the marks of beauty. But you know, the Buddha gave these meditations where you analyze the asubha type of meditation, whether you see the underlying reality of the object, or the sort of the impermanence or impure aspect of the object, rather than focusing on the superficial marks. Because we sensual desire comes from focusing on the superficial external marks of an object. So you see a man or a woman, for example, and you fix on the outer marks, the color of the hair, the skin, And we get attached to that. But instead you train yourself to see with X-ray vision. What you see is just blood, skeleton, blood, and odors underneath the skin. Then you won't have so much attachment to that. Or you even with food, attachment to food, you can say, well, this food, most of it has pesticides in it, most of it has all these other impure things that make me sick. And maybe that will help you to let go of your craving for whatever it is it might be. So there's different ways that you can, you analyze the thought in order to be able to let go of that obsession with it, and then it drops away. So these are how we can use thinking to be able to let go of our useless thinking, or the wandering mind, and therefore then come back and refocus on our object of meditation, rather than just letting our mind wander. Or the fantasy. So you can also contemplate death. And if I was to die now and my mind still has all these thoughts of ill will or lust, desire or confusion, then, what's gonna, where's my mind gonna go? Where's this mind gonna go? And so it can help you to, muster up the energy not to entertain those fantasies. Because a lot of times we like to entertain our fantasies. Plotting revenge, how to get even with somebody, or whatever other lustful desire or fantasy that might be happening, or just worrying about some problem that you have. The mind just gets some cheap thrills out of, indulging in these thoughts, but actually they really don't have much benefit. So you have to generate the effort to try to let go of those thoughts so that you can come back and refocus on your you know, come back to the present moment and continue deepening your mindfulness and concentration. Now I know there's, you know, a lot of you have been practicing meditation for a long time. Others maybe just maybe not so long. So everyone's at a kind of a different level of practice. That means different level of concentration and mindfulness and also wisdom. So mindfulness, concentration and wisdom, these are the three primary mental powers that we are cultivating when we meditate, called powers of the higher mind. Called a higher mind because most people are locked in their lower mind. That means the lower ordinary mind is the mind that's just dominated by desire, aversion, ignorance, dominated by thoughts of I, me, and mine, and just basically swirling around, going around in repetitive patterns of alternating greed, hatred, and delusion. So in meditation practice, we're learning how to tap into the powers of the higher mind. But it starts with, again, developing mindfulness and concentration to the present moment. And a lot of people, they ask, well, how much concentration do I need? There's this talk about, oh, you have to develop concentration to a certain point and only then you start practicing mindfulness or vipassana. And other teachers are saying, well, you just directly start practicing vipassana and don't worry so much about concentration. So you hear lots of different theories about that. But in following the four foundations of mindfulness, you know, if you read the four foundations of mindfulness sutta, as I mentioned before, first establishing a good sitting posture, and then tuning in to the breathing, being aware of breathing in, breathing out. And the breathing is used as an object in the present moment to bring our mind back to when it's gotten lost. And so in the beginning it's a struggle to keep bringing the mind back, bringing it back each time it gets lost. But as you gain success or develop the ability to notice the hindrances, that's the main thing, is the mindfulness is the most important, because if you're not mindful, you'll be totally always lost in your hindrances. So it's by developing the alert mindfulness that you automatically gain concentration, because the mind's natural home is the present moment. It's just that we're distracted by the hindrances. So when you can hold the mind longer in the breathing body, just to the point of when you naturally start observing other things, like, you know, you're aware of the in-breath coming in and the out-breath. And ideally, concentration means when you're aware of feeling the breathing process, but you no longer have to struggle at it. And the breath is kind of going in and out kind of by itself. But it doesn't have to be even, you know, as I mentioned before, even if it's just 50% awareness, 50% of the time that you're aware of the breathing, that would be a tremendous advance. And even that is enough Because in between the breaths, you can notice other things arising and vanishing. Like in between the breaths, or even at the same time, you'll notice an itch. You'll notice a muscle spasm. You'll notice something up there. Or you'll start to naturally feel more and more sensations. And those will help to keep your attention focused. And then you start opening up into impermanence. We'll talk more about that tomorrow, but because there's, you know, some of you might already be in that stage where you're practicing vipassana, a lot of people, they practice awareness of breathing, and they've been practicing it a long time, but then they ask, well, what's next? What's after watching the breath? And they, you know, they don't know what to do. They're just, you know, watching the breath, and they get kind of comfortable, and you know, they kind of get confused as to what to do next, or they get bored with the breathing. Or what is the trap of tranquility arises. If you get too absorbed in the breath and you lose awareness of the body and so on, then, you know, there's a pity and sukha, or the rapture and happiness can arise. The mind will become very tranquil and you'll feel very happy, and it's like, and you just kind of, you know, you groove, you know. And you lose your forward momentum. And the mind kind of just sinks or stays in this trap of pleasure. And you're just enjoying that. But that doesn't go anywhere. Once you get in that trap, that could just go on for a long time, but your meditation isn't going to really deepen. So it's what I call the trap of tranquility, not getting stuck in these very tranquil and peaceful or blissful states of mind. But you have to use that then to on purposely cultivate the perception of impermanence. And starting with, the other body sensations. And again, as I mentioned earlier, watching the various itches and other sensations as they're coming and going. And even as the breath is going in and out, you're watching other things. So the mind doesn't get bored. There's always something you can observe, some little itch, some little prickling sensation, some ache, pain. Or if there isn't any, then of course the breath is there, or just the vibrations of the body. And then of course you open up to be aware of your thoughts too. But more on that later on. But anyway, I wanted to just basically kind of go over those various ways of dealing with the hindrances, and that to continue working with that basic process of learning how to develop the mindfulness and concentration in the present moment of the breathing body, because again, that's, you know, that's where it's at. The breathing body, the whole world arises through this through the breathing body. And so to be centered and grounded in the middle of that is really the beginning of the Vipassana meditation, or the development of insight.